Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
The producers of this podcast recognize the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present, and those emerging.
The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
And I remember thinking at the time, that is great evidence. If you hadn't seen him with his clothes off, you wouldn't know he had a hairy back.
Surprise, Australian true crime listeners. Narelle Fraser is back. So many of you have asked to hear Narelle again, so here she is. You may remember I promised another episode with Roland Legg this week, and I haven't forgotten, but here's the thing. Due to unforeseen circumstances, Roland can't make our live show at the Yarraville Club on April 8, so our old friend Narelle Fraser has agreed to step in for that one too. That's right, you can see Narelle live on stage with Emily and I at the Yarraville Club. You can ask her questions while she's on stage, and if you're lucky, you might even get to take a selfie with her. Naturally, of course, there's a link in the show notes and on our Facebook page so you can snap up some of the last remaining tickets to that show. And there's also a link to Narelle's own podcast, The Narelle Fraser Interviews. We bring you an episode of that podcast today featuring former detective Tim Peck. It's always a treat to hear two detectives chatting, and this conversation is very special. I shall leave you now in the capable hands of the one and only Narelle Fraser.
My podcasts often deal with distressing situations which are not suitable for children, and some adults for that matter. Some of what I discuss may trigger uncomfortable emotions. If that does occur, please reach out to Lifeline, Beyond Blue, or any other support service or person you feel comfortable with. I'm Narelle Fraser. I was a cop with Victoria Police for 27 years, 15 of those as a detective, having dealt with all types of crime from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. I witnessed the effect crime has on all those involved and became one of those victims myself in 2012 when I was diagnosed with PTSD. However, out of adversity comes other opportunities like this, my own podcast. I still pinch myself, but thanks for listening and coming with me as we explore the human side and impact of crime.
But it wasn't addressing the issues. The issues were my values were so compromised that I couldn't get my head around how to manage that.
Tim Peck and I, we both remember the 2nd of October 2014 for reasons which couldn't have been more opposite. I was at my Victoria Police retirement function, surrounded by friends and family, laughing, crying, reminiscing with my colleagues. Pecky, as he was and still is affectionately known, was in the depths of despair, seeing no way out of his depressive state than to drive to a secluded area and end it all. Pecky and I had been with VicPol for years, and both of us had seen a lot, probably too much in fact, but not that either of us knew each other's situation. Pecky didn't end it all, thanks in part to a man whose name is probably very familiar to many of you, the lovely Mr. Ron Iddles. Little did I know, Ron couldn't attend my retirement function because he was on the road driving to a country town hours away where a member, a Victoria Police member, was extremely distressed. And that member was, at the time, Senior Sergeant Tim Peck. Today, I want to explore Tim's exit from Victoria Police, the road back to good health and productivity. We'll also talk to Tim about his work with Beyond Blue and his current responsibilities as Manager, Wellbeing Services at the Police Association and the development of a great project called the Blue Hub, providing immediate access to assessment, treatment and support for members impacted by poor mental health. And what a perfect position Tim's in to help other members. We've both come out the other side and we're testament to the fact that a mental illness diagnosis, it's not the end of the world, but yes, it's the start of a new one, a different one. And I think I could say hand on heart, we've both learned the power and strength of honesty and sharing our vulnerabilities. Welcome and thanks for your time today, Tim.
Well, thank you, Narelle. Lovely introduction. Great to hear from you again.
Yes, likewise. It's been a long time, Pecky.
It has. It has, and I love the name of your podcast, NFI. Have you explained to the listeners why it's NFI?
No, Pecky. I'm trying to leave that just – yeah, it's a long story, that, but I think it's quite cheeky and quite catchy, don't you?
Yeah. No, I'll leave it at that. I'll still have a stapler with NFI on liquid paper on the top of it.
Oh, dear. So as I said, everything I've said there is so true, Pecky. Could you give us a bit of a snapshot of your career with VicPol?
Yeah, I joined as about a 24 or 25-year-old. I wasn't someone who always wanted to join Victoria Police. I only joined because a friend I was working with at the time in a steelyard indicated he was joining and said it wouldn't be a bad career. And without really much more research than that, I applied and was successful in joining the academy. It was pretty soon after I joined that I realised that the only real area I wanted to work in Victoria Police was as a detective. And I pretty much from day one went towards that goal. So, worked my way through uniform with a very big focus on crime investigations and temporary duties, all aimed at trying to become a detective. That was 1994 when I joined. 2002, I had my first posting as a detective out at Mill Park, a regional crime unit there, which was a fascinating time and, great memories and so on. I then was fortunate enough to move into the crime department at the missing persons unit where I met your lovely self and plenty of other great people. And then when the missing persons unit disbanded, moved into homicide onto the floor, as they say, but the response crews where I stayed for a couple of years. I then moved on to Santiago Task Force. Santiago Task Force was set up for a specific crime theme, which was Middle Eastern organised crime. We'd had 14 unsolved non-fatal shootings in about a 12-month period, I think it was, and there was a task force set up at the crime department. I'll come to that later on. I was asked to go there, but there's a bit of a story to that, and that was 2009. And by that stage, I'd been a particularly senior connie for, you know, the best part of 7 or 8 years. I'd been involved in frontline duties that whole period of time, and the time had come to look at promotion, as we do in VicPol. Rather than take a step back, we just go up and keep trying to press forward. And between 2009 and 2014, I worked at a number of different areas, but managed to go from a detective senior constable to a detective senior sergeant in that four-year period, which was quite, by 2013, I'd reached that rank. So that was quite a rapid rise when you look at...
Certainly is. God.
And it was really built on, reputation was everything. Your reputation carries you a long way. It was built on a work ethic that clearly wasn't sustainable. I was available all the time. I didn't really worry about whether I was on call or not on call. If the phone rang, I'd answer it. And a number of my own traits that bought into that. So wanting to be the best at what I did, a level of perfectionism, not wanting to let others down, putting others before yourself. But most of it was tied to policing. And what I didn't realise at the time, that I do realise now, that I'd certainly lost my way as a person, that my other values were really important to me around family and health and my own peace of mind had slipped right away, and I was just focused on the one goal to my own detriment. So that's where I ended up. So I went through, divisional crime at Detective Sergeant out at Heidelberg, Banyule. It was Banyule Crime Investigation Unit, and then into the Intelligence and Covert Support area as a Detective Senior Sergeant.
You know, I get what you mean, Pecky, when you say that it's almost like policing becomes your world, because you don't want to miss out on anything, do you? You want to be there for all the arrests. You're virtually, when you're as keen as, say, you and I were, you want to be there, don't you? You want to be there to help your colleagues. You want to be there to help the victims, the witnesses. It's just something that it grabs you and just doesn't let you go, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think there's certain personality types that are drawn to the work, and one of the downsides is that we generally have a perception that no one else can do it as good as we can. And quite often, if it's your job, you want to do everything because you don't want to trust anyone else to do it because they've got other things to do and they won't put the same time, energy and effort in that you will. And you do build up this sort of your own persona about how valuable you are, and irreplaceable, and that no one else could do that interview as well. I know more about this than anyone, so it's my job, so I have to do it. And one of the really driving factors that I had to be the best that I could be, my strong belief was that I had to know more about any investigation than anyone else. So I would read endlessly, and I would research, and I would do all sorts of things in the intelligence world to find out more so I could get a result.
Putting yourself under enormous pressure, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yep. Yeah, and you tie that into the police folklore, you won't find these things written, but the police folklore that centres on things like, you don't take a sick day, you never lose a fight, you never lose a court case, all absolutely unachievable, but cause great anxiety and sense of failure if you do any of those, if any of those experiences occur to you, it's all your fault. So it's there is a real weight of expectation that's probably brought about more by the culture than any of the actual written policies or procedures. It's more to do with the individuals and how we perceive it.
Pecky, do you think that that culture starts at the academy? Like, where do we get that folklore that, you can't take the day off? You've got to be strong the whole time. You can't show any vulnerabilities. It's got to be begin at the academy, doesn't it?
There's a really great book I can't recall the name of it, unfortunately, but it's a study done out of the UK in the last 3 or 4 years, and it relates to policing specifically in the UK, and the conclusions of that were that policing culture is learnt in the first 4 years, and primarily, if you remember back, I'm sure it was the same for you. As soon as you walk out of the academy and you hit your first station, the first thing will happen when you sit in the van with a senior member is, well, forget what they taught you at Disneyland.
Absolutely.
That didn't mean anything. Yep. This is real policing.
Yeah.
So it starts from day dot.
Could you share with us some of, if there's a few incidents or investigations you were involved in that may have affected you probably more than you were prepared or brave enough to admit either to yourself or to others? Is there something that really, an incident or investigation that really stood out to you?
Oh, look, on reflection, I still remember my first session with a psych where I said it's nothing to do with trauma. It's nothing that I've seen that's caused my issues. And this was before, you know, well before I went off. Certainly there was lots of, you know, graphic and horrible things that we saw back in the day. On reflection, I think it's probably more the difficulties in dealing with families and loved ones who have lost, you know, people through crime, through homicide, that, you know, really that want to be able to help them and support them and provide them with all, you know, that answer that they need, and then failing to be able to do that really has a significant impact, more so than the actual seeing of you know, really traumatic events. I think it's those relationships, and probably not having the skills or the mindset to be able to manage those relationships. They really are complex. And, you know, we just get thrown into them. There was no training around how to deal with grieving families. And as you would know, in the missing persons area, I think I had four investigations where we resolved without finding a body, and telling a family that we're going to charge someone without a body when they've still got a belief that their loved one's alive is really difficult. And you sort of become a bit of the enemy in some ways as well. Hang on, aren't you still looking for them? Are they going to come home? When your firm belief is they're not. But trying to bridge that gap with a family or victims' families is really challenging. I think in the end that type of emotional distress was probably more difficult for me than the physical watching or seeing of trauma.
And you're right, Pecky, because I don't recall out at the academy, they might have changed it now, but out at the academy you didn't talk really about emotional distress or emotions full stop, because that was seen as weak, as fluffy. You know, you just didn't talk about that stuff, did you?
No, and it's, you know, it really is an area that has shifted a little in recent times. But, you know, the security of policing was that you knew you could go to work and no one would actually challenge you about any of that. So if you were a little distressed, if you were thinking, you know, I'm not travelling so well, the risk of staying with loved ones who would point it out and say, you know what, I think you are struggling and you do need to go and get some help, or what are we going to do to help you through this? The easy thing, ironically, was to go back to work, because you knew you wouldn't get challenged. The worst question that ever come to you, are you okay? And you said yes, and that was it.
That's right.
So it became a safe place. So you'd spend more and more time at work because you wouldn't be challenged. You could push those thoughts aside and keep working, and it just leads to a bigger and bigger hole that you can't find strategies to get out of as you develop.
You just talked then about not travelling too well. Was there a particular incident or time where you began to think, you know what, I don't think I'm going too well here?
Look, I'd had considerable issues with alcoholism for a long time.
Okay.
I grew up with alcohol. That was, you know, in the family, and not by any stretch of mine from a family of alcoholics. So I grew up in a country town where we all played sport and a big family. So alcohol was always around, is I guess the best way to put it. Joining police was just like joining a big footy club. There was always somebody around to have a drink with or go out with or whatever.
Yeah.
But for me, alcohol shifted. It shifted from an enjoyable and, you know, really, you know, social pursuit into something that was, you know, I hated, but I couldn't stop doing. You know, I reckon in about 2005, I got done for 0.07 after I'd done a warrant at work, and I'd driven home, and then I'd gone down to get some dinner later on, and I blew over. I didn't think I was over. And that was probably the first time I really started to think about my drinking and so on. And from then until 2009, I really did struggle with alcohol. 2009 was when I first saw a drug and alcohol, well, it was a trauma counsellor, in fact, and that's when we started to try and manage my alcohol better. But it was a really difficult cycle to get out of, because our whole culture was built around alcohol. If you won a case, you celebrated. If you lost a case, you celebrated. If you did a warrant, you celebrated. If you didn't find anything, you celebrated. If a police member died, there was a funeral, and everyone went and got it. You know, went to the wake. You know, there was always a reason, and alcohol was a really big part of of my culture. And in some ways, sadly, I think I ingrained that culture and taught others a very similar path, which on reflection is probably one of my greatest regrets.
Well, that's easy to say now, Pecky, isn't it? We've all done things that we shouldn't have, or we're not proud of, or you think, why the hell did I do that? But at the time, it's your way of coping. I'm just interested, when you went to see a drug and alcohol counsellor, was that with VicPol or out of VicPol?
No, there was no way I would ever have let anyone in VicPol know that I was speaking to somebody. That was my own doing. There was plenty of resources available if I wanted to use them within VicPol or through the police association. That they have, employee assistance programs, they have a psych unit, they have peer support officers, they have chaplains. There's no, limit. But the culture, again, that we were in, it was you didn't tell anyone. The first thing that happened is that they wouldn't let you work anymore, and work was the only thing that was keeping me going.
That's right. They'd take you off your case. They'd take you off the job. You'd be put in some menial, not that filing is menial, I'm digging myself a hole here, but we would be put into some filing job. And that's not what we wanted, was it? We joined because we wanted to deal with people and help people. And it was, and also you were sort of shamed a bit, weren't you, when you were put into the filing office?
The stigma was significant, and we still have those issues. Not so much now, but, you don't have to go back too far in the past where, a member who did experience a mental health condition and their OST or their, capacity to carry a firearm was removed, that there would be a big red cross across their firearm in the cabinet. Now, everybody knew, why is he off? Clearly there's an issue. So there was no, there was a real stigma around it. It's very hard to put police back into non-operational roles that are meaningful simply because of the nature of the way the organisation is set up. But I think that there's still that responsibility. I could have reached out to VicPol, but I was too fearful. And back then, certainly if I was thinking of promotion, in my mind, any declaration that I had a mental health condition would significantly impact me trying to get promoted, which is quite bizarre. Yeah.
What was it that stops us? Because I'm in the same boat. What is it that stops us from seeking help within VicPol? It's purely this. Would you agree? It's purely the stigma.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's probably a cultural aspect that grew up over time. But the ability to be able to reach out and develop your own plan of managing your mental health doesn't necessarily have to include VicPol. And I'm not saying it shouldn't include VicPol, but we each have a responsibility to look after our own mental health, and everyone's different and everyone will have their own way of doing that. So the way I sort of look at it now is that if people choose to use VicPol resources and so on, fantastic, go for it. If others choose to do it in other ways, that's great as well. The overarching part is, though, that it shouldn't impact on your career or on your capacity to find meaningful work if you're suitable for that work, simply because in the past you've had a mental health condition. If you're managing it well, it's no different to a physical condition.
Yeah, and that's where we've got to change. Yep.
If you break your arm, it's 6 or 8 weeks or whatever, or if you have a knee reconstruction, it's 12 months and you're back, and it's a pretty clear timeline and plan of when you're going to get back. Well, unfortunately, mental health, we don't know when we're going to be able to develop that strategy around us to be able to manage your mental health well. But we can return in a safe way and be just as effective as we were in the past. We might look at things differently. We might, use different strategies that we had in the past. But there's no barrier to returning. Obviously, some members become so unwell they can't return, and that's really unfortunate and sad. But that's part of the journey as well. Returning to functioning really is the first goal that I talk to many members about now. Once we return to functioning, we can make decisions about whether we return to VicPol. But the first stage is getting well again and then moving forward from there.
Yeah. Could you take us to the build up to that day in October and how you got to the point you did, where you didn't think you could continue?
Yeah, so that had been building up for some time. So 2009, as I said, I took promotion and went out to Moonee Ponds in a uniform sergeant role. I think I only lasted 12 weeks before I found myself into a plainclothes role again. But from that time, you know, from 2009 to 2013, really, I'd moved through a number of workplaces. The cycle would be I'd stop drinking generally for about 3 months, go to the new workplace, be a bit of a shining star, let the ego shine, have the homicide strut as you walked around and told everyone how good you were, what you could do. No shortage of self-confidence or ego. Really, you know, set up, and, you know, could have a really good impact and set up some good systems and, you know, teach members, and it was, you know, really enjoyable. But at the back of my mind, that nagging, you know, second sort of voice would come out, and that, you know, you're not good enough. Someone's going to catch you out and find out that, you know, you haven't done this or you haven't done that, or that property that you're meant to get rid of, you haven't got rid of, or that brief that was due at the coroner's court and hasn't been done yet, or you've taken on this project and you're not up to date. Someone's going to start working out you're not as good as you say you are. And that stress would build up, and then operational events and, you know, a whole range of life events and so on. And generally I'd go back on the drink. And when I got back into the drinking, it was binge drinking pretty much, and a lot of it by myself. And that's a really sad and self-destructive behavior, but it was only escapism. It was only trying to rid myself of those thoughts, and those thoughts that I was of no worth and useless, which was in direct contrast to the mask I put on and the image I portrayed in the workplace. So most people would have said he's confident and competent and articulate and intelligent. He's got it all going for him. But that's what they thought. Internally, I was exploding. You know, I would be anxious all the time. I'd be so shit scared that someone would find out that I was a fraud. That, you know, and, you know, as an investigator, you're looking at evidence, and, you know, I could show the evidence that I was good at what I did, but my mind wouldn't accept that. So this internal struggle continued along, and then, you know, just making really bad choices about work, about continuing to go down this promotion path because I had to be the best at what I did. So I would continually throw myself into work at the expense of the things that actually kept me well. So relationships at home, so family and kids, my own physical health, my own mental health. Whenever it got too difficult, I either went to alcohol or just threw myself back into work, and most of the time a combination of both. Fortunately, I was able to function at a high level whilst I was an alcoholic, which was quite amazing. I was actually known in my area as the highest functioning alcoholic in Victoria Police, but no one actually said to me, maybe you should do something about your drinking.
Did they make light of that? Did they, Pecky, or?
I only found that out later that's how perceived. But, like, people knew that I drank a lot, and they probably didn't know how much I drank. I was very crafty, you know. When you knew as many people as I did, you could move around in different circles of people and drink every night, and people not, you know, one group not be aware, you know, from the next group that I'd already been drinking the night before. And then, you know, cycle your way through a week and the worlds would never collide, so to speak. So my little secret was safe. But that only increased my anxiety. Well, what if they find out? What if people start to think? So that went through a real, you know, that cycle became more and more devastating as I went through. So, you know, when you get off the drink and you're 3 months off or 4 months off and you think, wow, you know, I've got this nailed this time, you know, I can do this. But the pressure would come back on and I'd, you know, inadvertently just go back. And at that time I was seeing a counsellor, and, you know, I'd done a lot of training in human source techniques at that time. So, you know, managing conversations and deception detection and, you know, all that, you know, getting people to do what you want them to do without them knowing, all that type of psychological sort of games we used to play. And I recall walking out of, you know, psych rooms and out of his room and just thinking, he hasn't touched me, this bloke. I've told him nothing about who I am. I'm way too smart for him. He'll never work it out. You know, going to lie about how much I drank or lie about what I was doing. And I never bought into the sessions. It was me, you know, babbling on about what I thought he wanted to hear. And really, I thought they were a waste of time. And the only reason I was going is because my wife basically said if I didn't, that'd be it.
Yeah. And was this with the VicPol, Pecky, or not?
No, all external, all through my GP. I was paying for it all myself for a number of years. And I guess getting back to your question, when did I realise it was all going badly? I'd known for a while, but I reckon about April of 2014, I first started having serious thoughts about suicide. So I'd been going through that cycle for probably 4 years. I was back on the drink big time. I'd been the type of person I was. I'd been through a period of not drinking when I first got the job. I was getting things set up. It was a pretty high-pressure job. I was well supported by my bosses. There's no mistake there. But and I recruited people who I knew and liked. So I had a really good team and all those types of things. But again, the doubts just crept in and my drinking started to escalate. And then I was paranoid about being followed, about, you know, having internal PSC following me, trying to find out whether I was drinking or not, and these types of thoughts. And then that would... And, you know, when you escalate that, it'd go into, oh, there's, you know, some of these people you've dealt with in the past, they're after you, you know, threats and all that sort of stuff that have been made in the past. Well, maybe they're trying to get you. And so my mind was really a mess. And I was very down on myself for not being able to manage my alcoholism. So I would, you know, get really, look, drinking is a horrible thing when you can't control it. You spend all day trying to convince yourself you're not going to have a drink. You get to, you know, 4 o'clock and then you have a drink. So you feel horrible about doing that and you've let yourself down and so on. You get to an hour of buzz time and that's, you know, makes everything go away. And then you spend the rest of the night just getting hammered trying to make it go away and wake up the next day and do the same cycle. It's so exhausting. It is nonsensical. It is soul-destroying in a lot of ways. So I reached a point where I didn't think I could beat that. And I could see the hurt I was doing to my family. I was really concerned about the reputational damage to VicPol if something did happen when I was pissed and I shouldn't have been. And I was really embarrassed about my broader family finding out the length of my despair and where I'd fallen to. So it's probably about April 2014 was the first time it jumped in my mind, well, maybe there's a way out here. Maybe suicide could be the way out. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's like a 10%, 90%, 10% comes in your head and you think, don't be a dick. That's not the solution. You know, you've got more to live for than that and so on. But as time went on, that shifted. That shifted to about, you know, 50-50. Yeah. And by about August that year, it was, I still recall it vividly, it was just after my 47th birthday. I was in a park in at the Darabin Parklands looking over the park with my wife, and I'd been... had a really bad patch at that time. I was really struggling with alcohol and work, and the marriage was really struggling. My relationship with the kids was in a lot of trouble. And I recall saying to her then that, you know, she said, well, why don't we, because we tried so many things. We tried changing work locations. Well, that doesn't fix things if you're not going to change yourself.
Yeah, you're right.
We tried, you know, little bits of time off here and there. And she suggested perhaps I take long service leave. And I'd reached the point where I said, it won't matter, I won't be here by Christmas. And I'd given up doing paperwork that I knew would be due by the end of that year. I was planning quite clearly that, you know, the time was coming and I would suicide. And that's one of my, you know, really great regrets. Like, what does my wife do with that? She knows I'm actively thinking about it. I wasn't telling my psych that because I knew that he would intervene. What does she do? Ring my workplace that I've, you know, turned into the bad people for the last 10 years, saying they're making me work all this overtime and making me do all these things, and when most of it was my own choice. Like, she couldn't ring them and say, I'm worried about him. Would she ring the GP and say, well, what are we going to do about it? Well, I'd deny anything anyway. So it just put her in this really horrible position of, is he going to come home every night? Am I going to see him again? And that was really, you know, digging away at me. But it is a really difficult thing to describe, and for anyone who's listening this may raise some issues for, I really encourage you to, you know, reach out to Lifeline or Beyond Blue or whatever other resources you use when you're thinking about these types of issues. But I actually got a sense of calm when I thought about suicide. It gave my brain a place to go to and relax, because I could put all those horrible thoughts away and just think, well, it's not going to matter. And that built up. I had a number of issues going on, and on the 2nd of October 2014 at 3 a.m. in the morning, after spending time again by myself drinking and so on, I crashed a covert police car into a parked car in Grange Road in Fairfield, absolutely hammered. The car was on its side when I worked out where I was. I remember the first feeling, thinking, if this is death, it feels pretty much like being alive. fortunately, because I was. And when they in time reenacted the accident, I wasn't very courageous either, as I was only doing 22 k's an hour when that happened. but I remember laying on the car, and I was on my side, and I couldn't get out. And if I had got out, I would have ran. I would have taken off, and they wouldn't have found me. And some, you know, members of the public come out and help me out of the car, and I'm, you know, just horrified at what they'd be thinking if they found out this bloke's meant to be out there protecting us and have a look at him.
Oh, yeah.
And then police turned up, and fortunately I hadn't injured anyone else, or you know, I wasn't too badly injured myself, and the police turned up and I treated them like rubbish. I wouldn't talk to them. I refused the breath test because I knew they couldn't arrest me, and then basically challenged them to arrest me under the Mental Health Act, or I was leaving, and told I was going to kill myself, and walked off. I jumped into a taxi and got a taxi into the city. So I was covered in blood and limping a bit, and jumped on a train.
God.
I think it was 5:30 in the morning or something by the stage, and got on a train and, you know, really, really confused headspace. But it's difficult to describe. If you had been in that taxi with me, I would have been able to do a pros and cons sort of argument and convince you that suicide was the way out. That's how clear my thought was around that. I'd sent text messages off to people saying, that's it, you won't find me. I turned my phone off, and off I went, and I jumped on a train and I went to Warrnambool. Now, hopefully there's no listeners from Warrnambool there, but really it's probably a sign of where my mental health was at, that if your last resting place of all the lovely places in the world, you pick Warrnambool, you've got some issues, I think. Only joking phrase, it's not a bad place.
Some very good friends of mine come from Warrnambool. I can only hope they're not listening.
So I got on the train, and I remember parts of the journey. I remember other parts being really distressed, crying and so on. And I remember sitting by myself, and we stopped at Geelong, and I got off, and then got back on, and I was really struggling. And I got to Warrnambool, and being the good alcoholic that I was, I couldn't do anything without having another beer. So I went to the pub at 9:30 in the morning. I was the first customer, and I asked him. My plan was to write my suicide note on my phone, and my funeral plans, which I'd been over hundreds and hundreds of times. I knew exactly what I was going to write. I knew exactly what I was going to say. I asked him to plug my phone in to get charged. And for someone who'd spent the best part of his career somewhat of an expert in tracking people on mobile phones and the like, I knew that if that happened, they'd find me. And I reckon within 10 minutes, there was a couple of coppers walked in. I thought, geez, that's odd. What are they doing here? And then it sort of dawned on me that the game was up, that they'd come to grab me. And it was a really strange experience, because even though I knew that the game was up, I just thought, if I play the game, I'll get out of this. They won't be able to lock me up, and then I can do what I need to do. So I hadn't given up at that stage. And then that's where, I had to go over to Portland and be assessed. And obviously I told them all the right things. I was pretty experienced in what to say, so that people wouldn't lock me up. Went over and saw a clinician over there, and they gave me all clear, and Ron drove down from Melbourne to pick me up and drive me back to Melbourne the next day.
How did Ron get on to you? What was Ron's association with you?
Ron was, I had obviously been my boss for a long time, and I'd sent him a text message that morning telling him I was going to finish it. He'd been ringing and ringing. Obviously, I had my phone off. I hadn't taken any notice. But I think when the police came in and they asked me, who do you want to contact? And I said, give Ron a ring and let him know. He'll know what to do. I was really embarrassed about speaking to my family. I was really worried about going home and seeing the kids. I didn't want my parents to know, siblings. It was a mess. One of the interesting things is, suicidal ideation doesn't just disappear. It's not like because that happened that it wasn't still there. Of course it was still there. But a few things started to shift. I come back to Melbourne. I knew I'd lose my job. So everything I'd worked for had been thrown out. My mind was, just racing. I couldn't sleep. I wouldn't take the medications they'd give me. It was a really – the only peace I could find was walking. I was probably 20 kilos heavier than I am now, just through drinking and not eating and not sleeping and so on back then. And I'd just walk. I'd go out and walk for hours, just trying to exhaust myself so I'd get some sleep. and listen to music, and generally really depressing music. It would just buy into my mindset.
But
Rung me off the next day, and it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And the wife was at work, and the kids were at school, and I remember sitting here and just thinking, "Wow, what am I going to do?" And again, the plans were all there. I knew exactly how I was going to do it and what I was going to do. And I had a psych appointment I had to go to that day. That was the only reason I was allowed to back. And I remember walking there. It was about 7.5 Ks, and I decided to walk. And it was just such the longest walk, and it was the longest walk back, and how many times I thought about, what I wanted to do. And it was just a really difficult time. But in that session, I can't remember if it was that day or it was in that first week, I remember talking to the psych, and it was the first time I actually opened up about how I was going, about what was affecting me and how I felt. And it shifted our relationship instantly. I've got no doubt some of the stuff we spoke about that I thought was rubbish probably saved me on that day, in hindsight. But one of the things he said was, I gave him all the reasons why I should complete suicide. And he said, you're very smart, Tim, and that's a great way of looking at the world, if that's what you want. But there's one major flaw in your thinking, and that is you're making decisions for others. You're making decisions based on what you think. So when you say that your wife's going to be better off if you're not here, I'm happy for you to go down that path if that's what you think, but you ask your wife first what she thinks. Ask your kids what they think before you do that, because you don't get to choose what they think. And that changed things a lot. That started me thinking, get out of my own little head. There's a bigger picture here that, the worldview of others is important. It's not the world according to me. And all that sort of self-centered, egotistical life that I'd lived for the last 7 or 8 years, and that's all it really was about. It was about me. Every sacrifice was made so I could get where I could get to. It really was a self-centered way. But in hindsight, again, I think part of it was because I had security there. I wouldn't get challenged if I was at work. No one would have a conversation with me and say, you are struggling, or I could keep working hard and get the plaudits, and then no one would think about it. This bloke can't be struggling because they look at what he's doing. So it was a way of hiding it safely, but it wasn't addressing the issues. The issues were my values were so compromised that I couldn't get my head, around how to manage that. So, one of the exercises we did was, tell me the most 4 important things in your life. And I'd say, my wife, my kids, my physical health, my mental health, my extended family. Tell me how many hours a day you spend thinking about them as compared to how many days you spend thinking about work.
Yeah.
How many decisions do you make every day where you put them first?
Mm.
And honestly, I could say I didn't put any decisions first about my family. Everything I did was for work. And I'm not blaming VicPol for that.
I understand.
That was my own personality and my want to be the best. I worked so much overtime that I was never asked to do. I just had to be there because I love the the reputation. I love the trappings that come with it, if you like, adulation. And, look at this bloke. He's a gun. He's fantastic. But I look back now and just think, for what cause? And it was quite clear that I couldn't have maintained what I was doing for an extended period anyway. The work rate I was trying to do with the alcoholism was always going to end badly. But in that mindset, I couldn't see that. So one of the real tricks, or one of the real problems that we have, is when you're unwell, you don't have that capacity to look from the outside in and say, mate, what are you doing? Like if you were to sit down and say, what's the benefits of driving when you let that night? What were the benefits? I was close to home. Quite easily I could have got a taxi. But what was the actual benefit of driving that night? And it's not logical. What are the risks? What could happen badly? Well, you could lose your job, you could lose your wife, you could lose your family, you could lose your life.
Mm. Or cause somebody else's life to end.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I would not have been able to manage with that at all. If I'd have injured someone, I would have been distraught. But why would you put yourself in that position? But we continually did, and that was my battle that I couldn't get around.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
So it started a whole new journey then. So after October, I was seeing my clinician regularly, very regularly, daily for a period. Obviously, there was suicide plans and things in place as in, you know, treatment plans to make sure that I didn't. I started looking after myself better physically. And one of the strategies we came up with, and look, the relationship I have with him now is fantastic. He's only just retired, this clinician, and he's been with me since then.
Your saviour, one of your saviours.
Yeah, he really is and I think it helped that he was outside of policing, to be honest. I think it helped that he didn't have to know my world, but he could listen and understand. And over time, we built up that really strong bond. And I think, you know, one of the things he really encouraged me to do, because when I finished work, I still had all the noise in my head. I still had all those operations and briefs and things. You know, I couldn't go anywhere. And I was so embarrassed that if I saw a police car, I'd hide. I wouldn't go out unless I was walking down, you know, walking along the river. I was shit scared to go to shops or didn't want to take the kids to school and things like that. I was just embarrassed that people would find out what had become of me. Continually, it's not as if the neural pathways in your brain just shift and you turn off work. They keep thinking. They keep, you know, what about this job? What's happening with this? How can you do this? Or you might be able to get back, you know, and all those little thoughts about, yeah, you could get back. You can do this. You're really good. They'll take you back. The other part of my head saying, well, don't be an idiot. Who's going to take you back? Look what you've done. There's no way. The reputational damage is way too big. So this internal dialogue just went on and on. So one of the things that was recommended, we did an exercise where we sat at our table in his room and we took everything off the table, literally everything off the table. So it was just a blank table. And he says, tell me what you want to do. If you're not a policeman, what are you going to do? And the first things come into my brain, well, you don't understand, mate. Who else is going to employ me? I only know policing. No one else needs to know how to write an affidavit to get a telephone intercept or to manage a surveillance team or, you know, to put a brief of evidence together or prepare an affidavit. Who else needs that rubbish? It's only policing. I'm no good to anyone else. I said, well, let's work through that. But if policing's off the table, what else would you do? What's important to you and what else would you want to do? And this took a number of weeks. And over that period of time, The things that really came to the fore was that I did like helping people. I was a strong communicator, so I could verbally and written form communicate well. And that it had to be something that was in line with my values. And we did a lot of work on what my values were. And the first one, I think you mentioned at the top of the show, was to be honest. Because if I'm honest with myself, I'm not drinking. If I'm honest with myself, my relationships are stronger. if I'm honest with myself, my physical health is better. Because, you know, I could go and have a drink any day now and no one would ever know except for me. So it's that honesty that really starts everything. So the first thing was I want to be honest. I want to be. Second one was I want to be compassionate, both to myself. So if I make a mistake, it's not the end of the world. But more importantly, compassionate to others. I needed to be tolerant of myself and the way that I was, but also tolerant of others. That if they couldn't work as fast as me, or as, you know, as intelligent as me, or whatever, that didn't make them bad people. Which was the way I sort of categorized things. If you weren't up to speed, piss off. I'll get someone who is. So I need to be more tolerant, and particularly in my own relationships. And the last thing was I just wanted to be the best person I could be. Don't worry about being the best investigator or whatever, just the best person I could be. So we had our four values there, and we had what I wanted to do and helping people, and I'm a good communicator. And we came up with counselling, that I'd like to be a counsellor. So we then went through and said, well, what course do you need to be able to do that? And we researched it, and I found a course at Ken Miller, who was a master's in counselling and psychotherapy. And I started that in 2015 and completed that last year, which was 2019.
Congratulations.
But that again was a real eye-opener, like going into that course where your first day, I remember, I couldn't read properly. I could read, but I couldn't retain things. My sleep was terrible. My memory was shocking. My concentration was horrible. Trying to write an assignment was just so far from where I was at. But I just persevered. I only did two subjects a semester and just tried to get through. But I remember the first day seeing this room of, 40 or 50 people, and nobody knew who I was, much less nobody cared. They all had their stories and I had my story, but I didn't have to open up and share it or anything. It was simply, first of all, just observing and listening to their stories and then thinking to myself, I wasn't really living a very normal life. The things that I was involved in weren't what normal people have to do.
No.
Policing is a really unique experience. And that course really taught me so much about myself more than anything. I'm qualified now if I wanted to be a psychotherapist, but I think for me it was more the benefit that I got personally. I didn't do the course so I could, have a career pathway. I did it because the learning actually got my brain working again. It got me to understand mental health much better. And fortunately, it led to the role of Beyond Blue that you touched on earlier. So after I'd been through that experience of pleading guilty at court, in the same court where I'd locked up I don't know how many people, court two at Melbourne Magistrates, Norrell, where we'd had so many bail applications and so on, here was I as the defendant in June of 2014. And it was just a terribly humiliating experience.
Yeah, this was for your 05. This was for that accident.
Yeah. So, because I refused the breath test and the careless driving, and having to get represented, having to ask former colleagues to write referee reports for you was just humiliating.
I can imagine,
and embarrassing.
Pecky. Yep.
I remember hiding in the park with my wife right up to the last minute when my barrister rang me and said, we're getting called in a couple of minutes, and rushing through and sitting in the court and by myself because I didn't want to put my wife through it. It was just the most gutting experience, I think, that I've ever had. Back home, and then, I still hadn't heard much from Vic Pol at that stage, and it took another 6 months before I got to a discipline hearing. So it was the end of 2014 that I finally got to a discipline hearing, and even then, ironically, I was still trying to get back to VicPol. I'd started the course, and I went back with a plea that I'd go to welfare and drop rank and be a sergeant and just teach people what I knew, and hopefully they'd learn from my experience. And the discipline hearing officer, probably in his wisdom and quite rightly, said, I'm barking up the wrong tree, and it's unsustainable for you to remain. And it was the best thing that did happen because it put a full stop on my career, and I resigned. Just after that, I was really fortunate. I started at Beyond Blue the week after, which was just an absolute.
The week after?
It was a fluke. But when I left VicPol, when I put my resignation date in, my starting date at Beyond Blue was the week after. There was a part of my course, I had to do 300 hours of counselling as a volunteer to build up hours. And I rang Beyond Blue to see whether they had any, whether I could volunteer there to do counselling. They don't actually. They outsource all their counselling. They don't do any there. But the girl I spoke to, I told her the story. I said, this is where I'm at. And I was really honest and said, you know, stacked my car and, you know, had my own mental health issues and I'm studying and blah, blah. And she said, you wouldn't believe we've had a position for a national engagement manager for the Police and Emergency Services program we haven't been able to fill. We were looking
for a
former member with a lived experience who's happy to share it and who's got some education in mental health. And it took, I went to an interview and got selected and started there in late January 2015. Spent that year travelling around Australia to all the different agencies and unions, so all emergency service unions and agencies across Australia, speaking about the good practice framework, which is developed by Beyond Blue to help develop mental health strategies in the workplace, continued to study. And it really was an amazing experience. Like previously, every trip I'd ever done in a state with work was all about how much alcohol can you smash in.
Absolutely. After you get the job done. Yep.
I was travelling by myself. I haven't had a drink since I crashed the car in October 2014, so I'm coming up 6 years in a couple of weeks.
Oh, Pecky, that is so good.
But it was just a completely different experience. The actual, you know, flying and so on was actually my downtime for me just to be at peace with myself. No one could contact you, and it was a completely different workplace to Vic Pol. It was amazing. I still have great friendships, particularly with, you know, my manager back then. She's fantastic and we keep in touch and often bounce ideas. So Beyond Blue was a great experience. It got me into contact. But one thing it did teach me was about the role of unions in mental health, because my experience, and I'm not being critical of TPAV, but my experience was that back then if you had a mental health injury, it was pretty much get a pension through your superannuation, put in a cover claim and off you go, you're done. I was 47 and I knew I had more to offer than that, and I wanted to be, I was determined to try and get back in some way, shape or form. And I'm not saying that strategy doesn't work for some people, but for me that wasn't going to work. We needed, and there was a real barrier between the union and the organisations, and this is not just Vic Pol and TPAV, this is across Australia.
Yes.
That the union would say don't go to the organisation for help because they won't look after you. They'll try and, you know, knock out your work cover. They're going to say you can't be operational. They'll try and ill health retire you, which most of is untrue, but that was the stigma, that was the folklore. So I was fortunate in January 2016 to land the role at, and Ron was the secretary, but I landed the role as the wellbeing manager at the association. Ron was on the way out. I think he left after only a couple of months, so he was finished up. But one of my first tasks was to really bring those two groups together. So Vic Pol Welfare and Wellbeing Unit and our Wellbeing Unit now are a far more cohesive unit. We actually both have resources that can assist members. Why would I say don't go there if there's resources that are free and good? We don't have enough resources to manage everyone. We certainly don't have resources to manage the high-risk people. Vic Pol have a 24/7 psychologist available. Why wouldn't we encourage members to reach out? So that was the first shift in thinking, and that probably brings us to, you know, the Blue Hub model that sort of evolved out of that, that one of the real gaps is that when members put their hand up to come forward, there's actually nowhere to go. So we're getting really good at reducing stigma and getting people to come forward. Yep. They have to wait for the treatment. And our evidence shows that, you know, even when they do come forward, they're not getting the right treatment. So they're not getting assessed correctly. And the evidence-based treatments that, you know, provide the highest probability of an outcome, a successful outcome, aren't being used. So in my head, that sort of bounced around for a while. And we were fortunate enough through an application through the Police Federation of Australia, the federal government, to land $2.5 million for a pilot in Victoria for the Blue Hub model.
Wow.
We've engaged Phoenix Australia, and in the next month or so we'll kick off with a number of service providers in Melbourne, and we're looking at a couple in regional Victoria where there will be a 1-800 number and a website where you can reach out to. You'll be triaged by a clinician from Phoenix, and then within 5 days you'll be off to your first assessment, which will be a 90-minute full assessment of your mental health, and from that, within 10 days of that, you'll have your first psychology appointment with a clinician who has done 5 days training through Phoenix in police culture and the evidence-based treatments and recommended treatments for trauma-related injury. So it really is about getting people in quickly streamlining the workover process so that we can get an early assessment, the right treatment, and hopefully people back to work quicker rather than that big delay in treatment that leads to so many other issues.
When I look back, I think if there was a blue hub when I went sick, you know, I and probably you as well, I'm sure, we probably, possibly, could still be doing what I consider to be the best job in the world. I loved it. And if there was that sort of support services, I just think what a credit to Victoria Police and the association you are, because it's that lived experience that has catapulted you to do this, like it is encouraged you to do it because there was nothing like that. I just think hats off to you, Pecky. I'm sure there are so many members out there that will benefit so much from your passion, but also, unfortunately, your fall. You know, it's really a story of hope, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's not just me. You know, there's so many other members I speak to all the time in my current role who are going through, you know, similar stories, and to be able to provide some sort of system that we can treat them better. But I think the next step, and you know, unfortunately, my brain doesn't stop for long. The next step really is around how do we get into that preventative phase? How do we start to educate members about what they can do to prevent them reaching the point where they're reaching out in crisis? Because that really is the crux of it. Policing's a unique environment, and you know, you can pull any mental health strategy or mental health program off the shelf. And my view is that most coppers, being as cynical as they are, will say, yeah, good for them, that doesn't suit me.
Yes.
And the success of Dr. Gilmartin really outlines that he came from a policing perspective, and people loved him because he spoke about police experience. And that really is the next phase of what we're looking at. How can we develop resources that members can engage with that are actually directed to the members? So the examples we use, the language we use, is actually for policing, because they're so alienated in community. I know that sounds odd, but it's true. When it comes to mental health, you don't want to go to the local, you know, emergency department and say you've got an issue when there's going to be three blokes there you might have punched on with 3 weeks earlier at a pub fight or a domestic violence incident. They're not options open to police. You can't go to a support group and start talking about your experiences in policing, because public doesn't, you know, aren't ready to hear what we have to say. So we do need to develop resources that are police specific. And I think, you know, with Wayne Gatt at the helm and his, you know, drive and passion around this type of thinking, I think we will get there to develop. And it won't be in competition with Mick Paul. It'll actually be in collaboration with, and to, you know, really supplement what they're doing. So it's not about, you know, trying to who's got the best programs. It's about how many programs can we provide that actually suit our membership.
Yeah, what is best for the members. Pecky, do you think that VicPol members becoming mentally unwell, do you think it's your own personal view, obviously, do you think it's to do with, I don't know, the length of service, their age, the type of investigations they're involved in, I don't know, the stigma, the lack of emotional intelligence or education for our supervisors? Where do you think it is? What's the problem?
Well, you know, all of those things you mentioned were in the review by Peter Cotton. You know, the 39 recommendations that come out of the Victoria Police Mental Health Review touched on every one of those issues you mentioned. I think we do have a better understanding of the problem. What we're struggling with is finding solutions. And what we've done at the moment is really focused on those in crisis, which is, you know, appropriate. We need to focus on those. But we've really got to start now looking at that next step. How is it, as you say, and one of the benefits of Blue Hub is those assessments. There is a big research component to Blue Hub as well. We'll, for the first time, be collecting data from all these members who are coming in crisis and understanding what is it that's causing this, and what treatments work best for which presentation. So it gives us an opportunity to start to understand why we have so many members impacted. You know, is it more a societal thing that we're, you know, in society more broadly, mental health's a far bigger issue than it has been in the past? and you know, they're in the highest risk industry for a mental health injury in the state.
Yeah.
Are they spending enough time on preparing for such a career? So without taking too much time, I'll give you a quick example. When I speak to the recruits, you know, when I joined, you had to be able to reach, you know, marker A, B, C and D to be physically ticked off to join VicPol, because physically it was a demanding job. So you had to be able to swim 50 metres, you had to be able to go over a bloody fence, you had to be able to run so far in a certain time. So if you wanted to join and you weren't up to that, you would go and get a swimming coach. You would go and run and practice and train. You would every day, you'd change your diet, you'd you know, look after your sleep, you'd do all these things to make sure you're physically right to get over that hurdle. In fact, you're far more likely to get a mental health injury than a physical injury. What effort and what thinking do we put into our mental health? Because my strong belief now is that it's what we do every day with our mental health that matters. It's the little things that we do personally every day that allow us to manage our mental health. And once we understand those and know that they can change over time, and we reflect and we think and we, you know, reflect on our day and think, well, what went well and what didn't go well? Why did I feel so anxious during that period, but the other period I was okay? How did I manage those, you know, really intrusive and negative thoughts when they came in? What was the techniques I used that worked? That reflection piece, the other piece around diet and exercise and sleep that we know ties into our mental health. It may be that you see a clinician every month. It may be that you've got a, you know, it's your parents you go and see, or a friend or someone that you talk to. But developing that plan so that every day we start with a positive outlook on how we're going to go, accepting that during that day you may well experience anxiety, you may well feel a bit down, but that's life. Anything we put effort into is always going to have a downside. Tell me a relationship you've had that's meaningful that hasn't had some difficult periods where there's been a lot of angst, a lot of anxiety. But that's the benefit of the relationship. That's why it's so strong and so beautiful. But if we continually put everything into that, what I referred to earlier, that, you know, the VicPol bubble, and we neglect ourselves and the little things that we need to do every day, you can't just walk back to that. You can't give everything to VicPol and be in that secure place that you perceive to be secure. And I don't want this to sound like I'm using VicPol more as an analogy, not a...
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you know, I understand. Yeah.
So if you put everything into policing, it would be a better word. And that's where you go, because you know you won't be challenged. You know you can keep working and you'll get that good buzz because people say you're good at it. But you neglect and don't love and don't nurture the other part of your life. If that bubble bursts, the blue one, what have you got left? And when we talk about transition to retirement, how often do we see that happen? They're going to leave, but what am I going to do? Because I haven't nurtured and loved and cared for the other part of me. And that's really the message I'm talking about when we start now on a new way of looking at how do we educate and train our members around mental health that's different to everything else that's been offered before, that's actually specific to policing.
I think that's probably a good place to finish off, Tim. I suppose in closing, I want to thank you for what you're doing for members and their families out there who are in the position that you were in a long time ago. And, you know, what I'd love to do is thank your wife and family for their love and support of you, Pecky, because without them, I hate to think where you'd be, but thank you so much for your time and for what you're doing for the community. Thanks, Tim.
It's been a pleasure. And, yes, I thank myself every day for my wife and children. They're fantastic.
Yeah. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you to Tim Peck and, of course, to Narelle Fraser for allowing us to share that episode with you of her podcast, The Narelle Fraser Interviews. There's a link in our show notes to help you subscribe to that show. And, of course, there's also a link to help you get your tickets to see Narelle live on stage with us in a couple of weeks at the Yarraville Club. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.